You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Well, we opened there with a blast of Saturday Night Fever, and that was footage that we were all able to watch. Unfortunately, it doesn't work so well in audio, of Daniel's famous dance-off with Julian Alaphilippe a few years ago.
That's a lie. You weren't there, were you? Were you there?
Where was it, Daniel?
It was in what you once referred to as a discotheque in Madrid somewhere.
Incorrect.
In Madrid somewhere. 2017, I think it was.
After the Vuelta. Vuelta after party.
Witnessed by, I think, if you are trying to assemble witnesses, Superman Lopez might have seen it. Thomas Mosinski.
Oh, he talks about it a lot.
He talks about it very fondly. Yeah, often references it in interviews.
This image of Alaphilippe and Daniel engaged in a dance-off with Superman Lopez kind of flying, hovering over the dance floor, cape flying behind him. Well, that was quite a good way of getting some information about that from Daniel, wasn't it? And we're joined by Lionel.
Daniel doing the birdie song and Alaphilippe doing the Macarena. That's what I'm imagining.
Alaphilippe's musical taste, this came about, this revealing of this very trivial and embarrassing detail. I volunteered it, didn't I? But this came about because Alaphilippe posted a video of himself dancing relatively well, but his favourite musical genre, mine, did not in 2017 really align. He's more sort of Ministry of Sound. I'm sort of more Wu-Tang Clan. Anyway, go on.
Well, one final question on it. When you say dance-off, you were obviously in a dance-off with Julian Alaphilippe. Did Alaphilippe know that he was in a dance-off with you?
It had very much the feel of a dance-off. There was a lot of strutting and there was a lot of sort of, you know, pointing at the floor and sort of, yeah.
As I said, the birdie song, that was what it was.
Let's get on to the cycling, shall we?
Yeah, well, I got more information about that from Daniel than I was expecting there, I must confess. Lionel, you're back.
Well, I am back, yeah, but I'm still in quarantine. Stage 8 of the Tour de Quarantine today, 6 more to go after this. It's starting to drag a bit. It's a bit like the Bink Bank Tour. No. Oh. I'm only joking.
Actually,
I mean,
we're not going to spend too long on the Bink Bank Tour. It started today. We're recording Tuesday evening, but unusually, I always quite enjoy the Bink Bank Tour, but it's quite a good warm-up for the classics, isn't it, this year?
Well, not for Oliver Nasr.
No.
He was caught in a crash 3 kilometres from the end and was pushed over the line by the Belgian champion and wasn't pedalling with, I think, his right leg, was he? He was just pedalling with one leg, so not a great warm-up for the classics for Oliver Nasr. But, yeah, in general, I guess a week's workout for them.
Yeah, I was sorry to see that. I always kind of want to see Oliver Nasr doing well. He leaves a good impression, I think, Nasr, when you speak to him, or when you see him walking away from races, pulling his suitcase behind him, as I've seen a couple of times.
Do you think all these chaps know when the classics are? Because I'm a bit sketchy on that. I'm a bit foggy on which classic is when. This reminds me, actually, of something that happened at the Dauphiné. I don't think I talked about this a few weeks ago when we were at the Dauphiné, or I was. I was curious as to why Alexander Kristoff was at the Dauphiné, because there were no sprint stages, and apparently he'd put his hand up for the Dauphiné and said, yep, I'll do that, thinking there was a sprint stage, and he got there, and the day before the race, was looking forlornly through the road book and then realised there were no sprint stages and realised he'd made a terrible mistake.
Excellent. Well, listen, Daniel and I did a podcast Saturday looking ahead to the road race. We're going to be talking about the road race mainly in this episode, aren't we? Julian Alaphilippe's fantastic victory. But there was a fairly serious omission from the news roundup on Saturday, and that's why we had to get you back in, Lionel. Can you give us a news roundup, please?
Well, I've only got a few points of order.
As long as one of them's about Nairo Quintana, please.
Well, you omitted to mention Nairo Quintana had his hotel room searched at the Tour de France, that there was the early stages of some sort of investigation into Quintana and the Arkea Samsic team. don't know too much more about this. Daniel, have you been following this story since the tour?
Not a lot of information has emerged in the last week, but one interesting thing we obviously didn't mention last week was that you, Rich, you tipped me off about this, and you'd been tipped off about it during the tour. I think it was on, was it the next day? You'd heard
it,
a rumour.
It was Meribel. Yeah, it was the morning of the Meribel start, yeah.
There were people on the tour in other teams who seemed to know something about this, and they said at the time there'd been a drugs raid or a drugs bust, but it didn't really follow the kind of pattern that we were familiar with, you know, years ago, when a rumour would sort of grow and snowball and eventually become a story in the next one subsequent hours. It sort of fizzled, didn't it, Rich? And we suggested, we suspected that it was made up.
I got a message from somebody on a team asking whether I'd heard anything about a police raid on a team, and I replied that I hadn't heard anything, and the response was, well it can't be true then, which I was quite flattered by, because I didn't know, and I didn't know, and I didn't think my source knew either, the identity of the team and the rider. But yeah, it was seems to be concerning Quintana, his brother Dyer Quintana, and winner Anacuna, this sort of Colombian trio on the Arkea Samsic team.
Well, the details of this are that the investigation comes from prosecutors in Marseille, and the French newspaper Le Parisien was reporting that some saline and injection equipment have been found during the search of the Arkea Samsic hotel rooms, and Nairo Quintana, Dea Quintana were questioned by police. It's gone quiet since then, and Quintana has said that he's not been accused of wrongdoing by the authorities, and that substances that were seized were perfectly legal vitamin supplements. So we await more news from the investigators on that one.
I suppose the most intriguing thing, chaps, and the question that we've sort of wrestled with over the last week is where this came from, where it originated from. I mean, the Marseille link is an intriguing one, because there aren't really any obvious links with Nairo Quintana's entourage in Marseille, nor his team. His team's a Breton team based in the Brittany region. Yeah, difficult to see where that's come from. I know where, there have been some conspiracy theories linking this whole affair to Marseille. For example, the Delco Pro Conti team is based in Marseille, and there were some wild suggestions that maybe they were aggrieved at not having got a wild card for the Tour de France. I've also heard people murmur that maybe Arkea were not happy with Quintana's performance at the Tour de France, of course, before the crash that compromised his Tour de France. And, you know, who knows, that he's on a very onerous salary, I believe. Were they trying to get rid of him? Or, I mean, that seems like, you know, the sort of the stuff of, I don't know, Poirot, Clouseau.
It wouldn't be a great move, would it? I mean, it wouldn't be great in terms of sponsorship and how it looks and reputational damage to the team. He did race quite a lot in that area at the start of the year, didn't he?
He did. He had some impressive performances in that area, in Tour de Provence, sort of a race based around that neck of the woods.
Well, chaps, just another couple of items of news relating to teams and riders. We've heard today that the CCC team's World Tour licence is going to be taken over by the Belgian Circus Wanty team. So that's not so much a merger as one team organisation taking over the CCC World Tour license held by, among others, at Jim Okovic. So a changing of the guard there. Still quite early to speculate on what the implications of that will mean, but you have to guess that it might mean that some of the CCC riders who haven't fixed themselves up for 2021 will have a route to continue in the World Tour, because Circus Wanty presumably would want to strengthen in order to be a bit more competitive. Also, the NTT Pro Cycling team is looking for a new sponsor. They sent out a press release last night saying that NTT will not be continuing next season. So Doug Ryder, I gather, is already working hard to try to put something else in place, but that's pretty late in the day, even though there's obviously quite a lot of racing still to go this season. Quite late in the day to put something together for 2021. Hoping to speak to Doug Ryder about that. One of you chaps might be able to speak to him at the Giro next week and find out a bit more about what's going on there. And the Belgian press has reported that Lotto Soudal are having a real clear out. 10 riders, 10 of their more experienced riders are leaving, and they are replacing them with 10 riders all aged between 20 and 22 from predominantly from their development squad. Among the riders leaving Lotto Soudal include former Paris-Tour winner Jelle Wallace, double Vuelta stage winner Thomas Marcinski, Adam Hansen as well, and Britain's John Dibben. So again, riders who will be looking for alternative teams. And you did ask at the start of the news roundup, what's the order of the classics, Daniel? Well, I can tell you that Flèche Wallonne is on tomorrow. Liège-Bastogne-Liège is on Sunday. That's then followed next midweek by Brabantse Peel. Then it's the Amstel Gold Race in Gent-Wevelgem the following weekend, and then it's the Tour of Flanders, and then it's Paris-Roubaix, which is scheduled to be on the final day of the Giro. So the classics are all kind of mixed up, shaken up, and we'll have to see who targets which races.
And which races happen.
I heard that now from a couple of people that some of the one-day races might be in jeopardy, but we wait and see.
And of course, chaps, Julien Alaphilippe, as things stand, will get two classics campaigns in the rainbow jersey.
That's, yeah, good point, yeah.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iWalker.co.uk. iWOCA.co.uk.
Thank you very much indeed to our headline sponsor, iWalker. They took over as headline sponsor of the Cycling Podcast in March. They can help you if you run a small business. Go to iWalker.co.uk to see what kind of loans they can offer. But they're rated very highly on Trustpilot if you check out their reviews there. You mentioned Julien Alaphilippe getting two classics campaigns in the rainbow jersey. iWalker getting two Giros in the one calendar year with the Cycling Podcast, because we're off to the Giro on Saturday, well, Friday, having also done our Giro earlier in the year when the Giro should have been on, but we'll get onto that later. World Championship road race, Julien Alaphilippe. It was a slow burner, wasn't it? It didn't follow the trend of recent years of having a big loop before a finishing circuit. The race was entirely on a quite a big circuit, really. It looked fantastic. I mean, you know the area very well, Daniel, and we kind of know it from the Giro as well. It looked wonderful. I was just in awe, really, of the organisation of that race. You know, countries or regions have years to prepare for a world championship usually. They threw it together in a few weeks, and it looked great. And credit to the UCI and the organisers for putting that on.
Well, one of the most impressive things, Rich, was the road, in the sense that, I mean, I'm in Italy at the moment, and we've talked over the past few years, we've maligned the state of Italian roads, and they are an unmitigated disaster in most places. And the whole of the, the Imola circuit, I think outside the motor racing circuit, pretty much had to be resurfaced at very short notice, and they did it.
On that subject, very quickly, we released yesterday Lizzie Banks' diary from the Giro Rosa as this month's Cycling Podcast Feminale. She talks a lot in there about the quality of the roads. It's a brilliant listen. If you haven't listened to it, do listen to it, please. It's a brilliant insight into the race. But yeah, the roads look great. That famous, now famous, camera angle from the helicopter was that was the sort of thing where you would have imagined in a normal year that had been thought about and choreographed, you know, for months if not years in advance. And so again, that was just quite a remarkable aspect of it. But what about the race itself? We'll get onto the, in inverted commas, controversy later about Wout van Aert and Primož Roglič. But what did you make of the race? It was a very slow burning race, but perhaps compensated for with a thrilling finale. Very sort of Milan San Remo type world championship.
Yeah, it was, Rich. I mean, you mentioned slow burning. I mean, it was no burning for 210 kilometres, really, wasn't it? There was the early break, which got sort of 5-6 minutes up the road, And then we always talk, or often talk, about the World Championships having attacks in phases. You normally get something that goes maybe 60, 70 kilometres, which will have kind of B and C listers in it, maybe, and it will be dangerous and it will wake things up. And then there's a kind of another big move, sort of maybe 50, 40 kilometres to go, and then the end game. This race didn't really have any of that, until really nothing of any note happened at all until the Tour de France champion Tadej Pogacar attacked with, 42 kilometres to go. And that was shortly after he'd had a bike change as well, because just sort of 8-10 kilometres before that, he was making his way back through the cars, back into what was left of the peloton. And then the speculation at that point was, will Pogacar have enough in the tank here to open up enough of a gap and then hold that gap? And I was thinking, well, it's doable, it's possible, especially when he got close to half a minute up with still a lap to go. It looked, you know, it looked like it was hanging in the balance there, but really probably too much to ask. And then the final 20-ish kilometres really made up for the rest of the day. I mean, you could have got away with watching the final hour and really not missed anything, but what a final hour it was, because Tom Dumoulin, you know, suddenly sprung into life, didn't he? He was the one who linked up.
I don't know if he sprung into life. He spent the whole day at the back, didn't he?
Exactly, relatively speaking.
I said on Twitter, he attacked like me getting up off the sofa. It was just suddenly he was there. But it was a kind of slow motion, but obviously very powerful attack. But it was, I love the way he just sort of drifted off the front, didn't he?
Well, and closed down Pogacar, which put paid to his chances of doing the Tour World Championship double, which would have been the first one since Greg LeMond in 1989. But that really woke everybody else up, didn't it? And then there was this little move with Vincenzo Nibali, Mikel Landa, Rigoberto Urán and Wout van Aert.
Nibali's attack, in contrast to Dumoulin's, was like me getting off the sofa if I've just poured hot tea in my lap.
Oh, very good.
If you realise you've left
wearing high-cut football shorts.
Or I can imagine if you'd realised you'd left your phone on the other side of the living room, probably.
You know, that reminds me, I was once wearing high-cut football shorts in the car one day, when old leather seats, and I was playing, when I was very young, playing with a cigarette lighter, and dropped the cigarette lighter and it rolled down the seat into my shorts.
Wow.
That's another story.
What a portrait of late 70s, early 80s Scotland.
That's nothing to do with the World Championships at all. Sorry about that.
Well, that little move of four did look pretty dangerous, didn't it? But they never got anywhere close to opening up enough of a gap. Then Guillaume Martin made a move, and you know, that was obviously a kind of an advance move with Alaphilippe in mind, and that really sorted things out on the final climb. And it was a stellar group of, I think, 8 or 9 riders that got clear that it was obvious from that point it was either going to be, you know, Hirschi or Van Aert or Alaphilippe, Nibali, Roglic, Kwiatkowski, Fuglsang or Schachmann. And as you said, Richard, you said a Milan-San Remo-esque finish. It really was, wasn't it? Alaphilippe made the obvious move, and it was the obvious move. And once he had the gap and no one was reacting to him, it was then, as we often see in these scenarios, full commitment at the front from Julian Alaphilippe and just that doubt and hesitation behind. And no one wanted to tow Wout van Aert to the line and then get jumped by the Belgian for the rainbow jersey. So the odds were with Alaphilippe, but he was made to work for it. It was it was a real head down effort, and a fully deserving ride that netted him the rainbow jersey. And the emotion afterwards was really touching, wasn't it? Obviously he lost his father earlier on in the summer, and you could see just what this victory meant to him. And somebody on Twitter said maybe, you know, losing the yellow jersey after the illegal feed sort of helped him out a little bit. And, it freed him of the yellow jersey, which he may well have held for another sort of 5-6 days. It might have kept him in the hunt overall and forced him to ride a very different type of Tour de France. So it's funny how cycling works out in some of these circumstances.
Yeah, I think you're right, Napalm. In the last couple of days, he's spoken a lot about how he treated the last week of the tour almost as a training camp, particularly for the Worlds. But just going back to what you were saying about Pog really starting hostilities with 40 kilometres to go, And the French team and team coach, team manager, team director, Thomas Vauclair, has been talking a lot since the weekend about their plan and how the team executed it to the letter. And it's very easy, I suppose, in hindsight, when your rider has won the race, to look like a genius and to look like, you know, a very complex strategy was perfectly executed. But what he said and what they actually did, the French, was that they had two riders, Quentin Paché, the B&B Hotels rider, and Nance Peters of AG2R. They sort of went to the front and they started to work with about 60 or 70 kilometres to go, I think. And what that was the beginning of a bit of a bluff by the French team. The idea there was to make it look as though they were starting to wind things up for Alaphilippe, and it was going to be all French jerseys from that point on. But then after they'd done their turn, they were going to peel off, and no other French riders were going to come through and sort of appear to finish off the job. And they thought, or Vauclair thought, that would give the other teams, the other riders, the impression that the French had wanted to start winding up for Alaphilippe. But in fact, Alaphilippe had said, or they'd found that Alaphilippe was not on a good day, and the other teams were no longer going to have to worry about the French and Alaphilippe. So it certainly worked. I mean, you obviously have to have a rider who can finish the job off. And I think another key move that you mentioned was the pull that Guillaume Martin did just before sort of Alaphilippe entered the scene. And Guillaume Martin sort of acted as the jawbreaker, the enforcer, the kind of Luca Brasi to Alaphilippe's Don Vito Corleone, a very genteel sort of Luca Brasi, sort of, you know, bowling into the club, quoting Proust, and, you know, with a dandelion peeking out of his top pocket. But it did the job, didn't it? And it sort of softened things up nicely. And the other thing that softened things up nicely was Michał Kwiatkowski's attack. It kind of reminded me of the stage in the Tour. You have to help me, who won the stage when the green jersey was decided on stage 19, when Matteo Trentin attacked, and then, oh, it was Søren Kraut Andersen. He countered perfectly. You know, Trentin had sort of been the jawbreaker there, and then Søren Kraut Andersen came through, and Alaphilippe sort of did the same with Kwiatkowski's attack.
I mean, I think the Alaphilippe French bluff is even more elaborate and impressive than that, Daniel. I think it started at the Tour de France last year, or just after the Tour de France. As I've been saying, Alaphilippe has not looked the same. Quite the same force. Okay, he was second at Milan-San Remo. He looked good there. And he looked good on stage two of the Tour de France. But he was having to fight, even in the Tour de France. I think it looked to me like he was having to fight for it a bit harder than he did last year. And it just looked to me like his edge had been ever so slightly blunted this year. But I did say as well on Twitter that it reminded me a lot of Philippe Gilbert in 2012. You know, he was so completely dominant in 2011, and then there was something apparently lacking the following year, and then he won the world title. And, you know, I think similarly, that's the race that had really been firing his motivation all year. Somebody, a chap called Kevin Guthrie, responded very wittily to that, saying, "So what you're saying is that Julian was riding a la Philippe." Very clever, very good, Kevin Guthrie. But there are parallels, I think, aren't there?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, it's always difficult to tell, isn't it, whether Alaphilippe has actually been slightly weaker this year. I mean, obviously, we mentioned earlier that he's had various things going on in his private life that haven't been easy to deal with. But, you know, has he been weaker, or have there been stronger riders? You know, we've talked a lot about a new sort of cast of characters emerging, and they haven't necessarily been the guys that he's been directly coming up against. But, you know, often it has been a case of one or two riders who have been better than him. I mean, Milan San Remo was a good example of that. It was, you know, you take Wout van Aert out of the equation, and suddenly Alaphilippe pulls off an incredible, you know, double, drops everyone. So yeah, it's difficult to pass that, but I think you're right to a large extent.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast Team Car at the back of the pack, please.
Seb PK interrupts this week's episode to remind us to tell you that it is sponsored by LACA. LACA has flipped outdated traditional insurance on its head with no more fixed upfront premiums. Instead, your monthly contributions are based on the collective's claims that month. Your maximum monthly price is capped, but the savings are all yours. And when things go bad, LACA have got your back. Claims are handled by experts and usually agreed within a day, with no depreciation or excess. They've ditched annual contracts locking you in. With LACA, if you want to leave, you can anytime. If you head over to laca.co, new customers can get £10 credit by signing up today with the discount code PODCAST. And for the rest of 2020, you can join the LACA Club for just £1. Get third-party liability cover plus stacks of cycling discounts from Komoot, Sports Pursuit and many more. You needn't be a LACA bike policyholder to join the LACA Club, and third-party insurance could really prove a sound investment. With £2 million worth of coverage, LACA's third-party liability cover is designed to protect you from any nasty surprises. Take out the £1 offer today by heading to laca.co/club. Here's a customer to tell us about his experience with LACA.
My name's Ed Block. Took up cycling just over 2 years ago as part of a challenge to do Land's End to John O'Groats, which we did in September 19. Started out with very basic bike, didn't even consider insurance because of the relatively low value of it. But once I started realising that cycling was going to become part of my life, I got more expensive bikes and eventually decided that I needed to get some insurance. And through word of mouth, really, I came across LACA, signed up for them. It seemed like a really good idea. I like the idea of the fluctuating premiums based on the level of claims that they're receiving. The bike that I'd used for Land's End to John O'Groats got a crack in it about 9 months after we got back. I went originally down the warranty route with Scott. So as soon as Scott said that they weren't going to cover it under warranty, that's when I made the claim with LACA. And it couldn't have been a simpler claim process. I sent in a couple of photos of the crack and then had an email from them to ask a bit more about the circumstances and when it had happened. And fortunately, I did know exactly when it happened because I heard the crack happen while I was out on a ride. So I just gave them that information about where it happened and when. They pretty much immediately agreed to pay for a replacement frame, which came from Scott to the bike shop where I'd originally bought the bike from. And they shipped it to me. And I, in fact, had the payment from LACA before I actually paid out to the bike shop. So yeah, it was completely smooth, very quick. Got the replacement frame. Interestingly, they even proactively offered to pay for any labour costs that would be involved in swapping all the components from the original bike onto the new frame. But as it turned out, I was planning to do that myself anyway. Very impressed. LACA themselves were quick as I could have hoped. And in fact, kept chasing me to say, when can we pay you? Which was a bit surprising, but really, really welcome.
Lionel, Daniel, were you surprised? I'm just teeing this up here. I'm just teeing you up.
Is this a bit of a bouncer coming our way here?
This is. Were you surprised by the lack of cooperation in the group chasing Julian Alaphilippe in the World Championship road race on Sunday?
Napalm?
No, not really. Not really, because it was going to require the same level of commitment from someone, or they all wanted to win the race, obviously, and if they had done too much in the chase, they would have been compromising their own chances of winning. So it's always just that same balance, and we make this point, don't we, about the difference at the front. There's full commitment because everything all in for the win for Alaphilippe, and behind there's just that doubt. There's no one wants to be suckered into doing more than the next person. And when they're riding along with Wout van Aert, he won the sprint for the silver medal anyway. If they'd all come together in normal circumstances, that group with Alaphilippe in it, I think van Aert would have been the world champion. What's the incentive for anyone to tow Wout van Aert to the line? And there's almost a sort of unwritten or unspoken thing, I think, among riders in a chase group, is if the rider who's out in front has taken the gamble, he's the one who's got kind of the upper hand, rather than just kind of stitch them up for somebody else's benefit, it's kind of up to the group to, without really, you know, too much conversation, it's up to them to each put in enough to close that gap. And they never really got committed enough to do that. So I know what you're getting at, the fact that Jumbo-Visma had two riders in there. Wout van Aert had done an awful lot of work for Primoz Roglic during the Tour de France, had really done fantastic work for the team. And the suggestion, certainly from the Belgians on social media, that Van Aert could have expected Roglic to return the favour. But I just don't buy that at all. The World Championships is about national teams. And I also think Roglic was on his last legs anyway. So, no, I don't think there was any expectation on Roglic to contribute to the chase any more than any of the others.
I think in this case, the more relevant point is the second one you made, Napalm, that he was cooked, Rog. He didn't have anything left. You could see from his sprint that he didn't have anything left. I mean, you know, he wouldn't have been the fastest guy in that group anyway, but I think that was the, you know, that was the main issue there. And
don't you think that kind of makes the case that, well, if he was cooked and couldn't win the race himself, or thought he couldn't win the race himself, that that's why people are saying he should have emptied the tank, trying to close the gap, or maybe get it close enough for it to all come alive again. I can kind of see that point, but I just don't think that's on the table in that circumstance.
No, and even to suggest that someone can pull out at, you know, a few seconds or 10 seconds at, you know, 800 watts, if you're cooked, you're cooked. I think the simple fact was that he didn't have anything left. You know, just on the issue of kind of skullduggery and other interests and team sort of club interests playing their part in the outcome of the World Championships, you know, maybe some of these theories would have more credibility if we were talking about a rider who, a Slovenian rider who was a small domestique at Jumbo-Visma, and, you know, a guy earning 100,000 or 200,000 a year. There's a very famous incident almost 20 years ago now at the World Championships in Lisbon, where Paolo Lanfranchi seemed to chase down Gilberto Simoni, his Italian national teammate, in favour to favour the race of Oscar Freire, who was his Mappe teammate. But and there was talk of money changing hands, but Lanfranchi was a humble sort of journeyman domestique for whom, let's imagine, hypothesize, there was a bonus of, you know, a cut of a world championship winning bonus on offer, that it might have made a big difference to someone like him. But in Roglic's case, I mean, certainly there'd be no financial incentive, I don't think, that would make him work for Wout van Aert. Just on the issue of club loyalties or team loyalties. In 1968, the Worlds were at in Imola, and the Italian rider Vittorio Adorni won, and there was the Belgians were up in arms after that one as well, because Rick Van Looy and Adorni had been off the front for most of the day, and at a certain point Van Looy was he was cooked and he got dropped. But Merckx didn't seem to really chase very hard from behind, and Adorni was a great friend of his, and he'd been his mentor at the Faema team. Faema, of course, made coffee machines, still make coffee machines, I think they're still going. Anyway, the headline in La Gazzetta dello Sport the next day was a coffee flavour in Adorni's World Championship victory.
Nice. Just on that issue once again, briefly, the other factor is that Slovenia had, you know, two of the favourites, outside favourites maybe, but two of the strongest riders in the field and a real chance of winning. And Pogacar said that he wanted to help Roglic try to win. And, you know, you could argue that his attack was part of a strategy to help Roglic. So it wouldn't have looked great if Roglic had then got into that lead group and helped a Belgian win, you know, from the point of view of his reputation and standing back home in Slovenia. You know, that would not have probably gone down all that well. But, you know, it's funny in cycling, because we kind of like the dark arts, don't we? The intrigue, the skullduggery, while officially not liking it. But here was a case of, it seemed to me, a world championship being quite honestly fought, you know, with riders riding for their countries and not their trade teams.
Well, we hear less and less, don't we, about of these kind of stories. I mean, the Italians used to spend months wringing their hands over, you know, which loyalties had been honoured and which hadn't in the World Championship road race. They used to go on and on about it all winter, as the Italians sort of retreated slightly in influence. That hasn't been quite such a pronounced theme. But I think in the last few World Championships, we've had a... Well, they've been quite scarce, these stories, these conspiracy theories.
We have to mention, of course, Tom Southam and Charlie Wigelius at the Worlds in 2005, where, you know, they were riding really for the Italian team, or doing a turn for the Italian team at a time when, if you were riding the British jersey, you might not have been expected to do much. But nevertheless, the outcry in the UK was quite significant, and it, you know, quite a controversial episode. And you know, you can imagine that Roglic could have gone from hero, not hero to zero, but it, you know, that's the sort of story that might not have gone down quite so well in Slovenia, especially when, you know, they've got somebody else now as well.
I think the point Daniel made about the, if it had been a lesser rider, you could understand something happening. But I think riders of a certain stature, you know, the spotlight is on them. I mean, we're talking about a group here which had, you know, Tour de France stage winners, Grand Tour champions, classics winners. And, you know, a little bit unseemly for, you know, Roglic to suddenly shed his Slovenia jersey, it would have been, to then work for a Belgian teammate, you know, all right, teammate for 364 days of the year. And but that's the way the World Championships is. Everyone knows that it's a race run by national teams. And, you know, well, I don't think that the top riders could really get away with that kind of thing, which is kind of what you're saying, Rich.
I just wonder as well whether the Belgian media had been sensitised slightly to this issue by what had happened with Dries Devenens, who is the De Koninck Quick-Step rider, Julien Alaphilippe's good, well, friend and domestique, who'd effectively, well, he'd abdicated his position, he'd renounced his position in the Belgian national team because he didn't want to be in a position where he might have to ride against Alaphilippe.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thanks to Science in Sport, our proud sponsors since 2016, and they're still with us. Thank you very much to Science in Sport. If you want 25% off, go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code SISCP25, SISCP25. On Thursday afternoon, I'm actually speaking to James Morton, nutritionist, at Head of Performance is his title at Science in Sport. Sorry if I've got that wrong, James, but I'm putting some of your questions to him and we'll play them throughout the coverage of our Giro and beyond, I think, coming up. Just on the Giro, we'll talk about that in a moment, but as ever, Stacey Snyder's making her beautiful mugs, cups, cappuccino sets. She does beer mugs as well now, and selling them, I would imagine, in two different batches. We'll let you know when they go on sale, the first batch, but the two good causes we've selected are, well, one suggested by Reed Hart, listener to the podcast, who wrote in and suggested the Bahati Foundation in Los Angeles, which empowers young people by providing them with life skills, programs that promote positive values, healthy habits, and, you know, all bike-related stuff. So the Bahati Foundation will be one of the good causes. The other one will be the Black Cyclist Network in the UK. Manny Arthur featured in one of our episodes during the Tour de France. They are actually very well supported as well by Science and Sport, who are, you know, great supporters of theirs. So there's a link there too. So we're delighted to support those two good causes. There'll be more information about them in this week's newsletter. And if you haven't signed up for this week's newsletter or any week's newsletter, you can do so at thecyclingpodcast.com.
Better get started on the newsletter. Put that on my list of things to do.
I can do the newsletter this week, Lionel. We take it in turns, don't we? Well, listen, we've kind of covered the World Championship. I think we can agree that it's good when a World Championship road race is won by a rider who is at the top of his game and who, you know, will, you would imagine, honour the rainbow jersey in the races to come.
Also, chaps, let's face it, if you were going to build a robot to win World Championship road races over, you know, a decade, given the usual sort of mix of courses you get over 10 years, you would probably build someone something like Julien Alaphilippe, wouldn't you? And he's, I mean, if you look at his palmarès, he's actually only won, I mean, he's only won one monument to date, Milan-San Remo. He's won a couple of Flèche Wallonne. But you would think that he now is entering and needs to enter the really fertile years of his career in terms of just building a legacy. He's already built a legacy in terms of how he's affected sort of hearts and minds and the emotional imprint he's left on French fans in particular, particularly at the Tour de France. But in terms of joining the pantheon of great one-day riders, it's in the next sort of 4 or 5 years that he's going to do the main body of that work.
And he'll wear the rainbow jersey for the first time at Liège, Bastogne Liège on Sunday. Could win that.
Which is a race he probably should win at some point, although maybe not on the... Well, maybe harder for him to win with the new finish, but it's certainly one he should probably add to his palmarès at some point. We are off to the Giro, aren't we, Daniel?
We are.
On Friday to Sicily. I think we're all set to go. The hotels are booked. Everything's organised, I believe. Have you got us a car?
Hope so. No, we haven't got a car, Rich.
Are you cycling it? I'd love to see. Yes. Excellent.
We're gonna have to.
Daniel's
swoop.
Doing on his skateboard.
We'll be swooping Superman style. Superman, of course, who is one of a clutch of riders who also rode the Giro. Who rode the Tour? Who are also on the Giro start list.
Tough ask, that isn't it? That's going to be pretty demanding, I'd imagine.
Particularly for a climber who is expected to do a job for his team in the last week. It might be slightly different.
Leave the team at the end of the year.
Yeah, it might be slightly different for the sprinters. I don't know how many of those will get all the way to Milan.
He's in for a shock when he then gets told he's got to do the last 2 weeks of the Vuelta.
Would
you put it past Vino?
It's just exactly the sort of thing Vinokourov would do. Send him to the
Superman. You say you want to leave.
I was standing a few paces from Vino on the final Saturday of the Tour de France. He was standing just outside the mix zone watching Superman sort of fall apart in the final time trial, and it looked rather salty, I would say.
That's when he got added to the Giro team, I think.
It was more vinegar than Vino.
When was he added to the team sheet for the Giro? Halfway up La Planche des Belles Filles, I think. It could be a big job for him as well, supporting Fuglsang. You know, he could have a serious bit of work to do. And it is a test of his professionalism, isn't it? When we think leaving the team at the end of the year, and he's just kind of gone so close to finishing on the podium at the
I'm tour. Sorry, I've just got an image here of Lopez getting back to the bus after that time trial on La Planche des Belles Filles, turning on his phone and finding he's been added to the Giro WhatsApp group. Oh, dear.
Oh, God. Oh, poor Superman. Anyway, we'll be doing the usual, aren't we? Well, we're doing something different, actually. We're not the usual. From Saturday, we are launching Lionel.
There's 37 consecutive days of racing, give or take. I think there's a couple of rest days in there as well. But we'll be releasing daily podcasts covering the stories, really. Our attention will follow the racing. So if Liège-Bastogne-Liège turns out to be a belter, I guess we'll give that more attention than less. And we'll take it all the way through to Madrid and the end of the Vuelta.
We're embarking on not the fourth or the third Grand Tour. We're embarking on what we're calling the Grandest Tour, are we not?
The Grandest Tour. That's what we're calling it. Yeah, there's a beautiful design.
Feels like it should be accompanied by a belly laugh from Christian Prude on that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's quite exciting, and we're breaking new ground, I suppose, with this. Maybe not all the races will happen, but if they do, we'll be trying to cover them as best we can. And Daniel and I will be at the start, well, at least the opening week of the Giro, perhaps a bit longer. We'll be checking in with Ciro Scognamiglio a lot. And then at the Vuelta, you'll be there, Daniel, working for ITV, but we'll try and check in with you there. And we'll have Dyrus at the Giro. We've got four signed up. We'll reveal them later in the week. And we'll get some Dyrus for the Vuelta as well. So it should be good fun. Should be good.
What's the latest, Daniel, on the weather, and particularly the last week in the mountains at the Giro, which will obviously be towards the end of October? I mean, are we confident that the stages will go ahead without some really bad weather?
Well, Napalm, I'm currently about 20 kilometres from the Colle dell'Agnello, which is it the Cima Coppi? It's certainly, it's over 2,700 metres. If it's not the Cima Coppi, then it's very close. And that usually closes, I think it's the last Monday of October, which is more or less, give or take a couple of days, when the Giro is supposed to head that way. At the moment, there's a bit of a sort of dusting of snow from about 3,000 metres altitude. So the Colle dell'Agnello is clear at the moment, but the snow, there's quite a lot of snow forecast for the weekend in this part of the Alps anyway, this sort of the Western Alps.
Well, listen, chaps, before we go this week and resume on Saturday, a final question for you. Who's going to win the Giro, Lionel?
I was just looking at the short list of, it's a pretty short list of established GC riders. I'm going to... I'll say Simon Yates will do it.
Daniel?
I'd say it's between Yates and Fuglsang.
Mm.
Not Geraint Thomas?
Forgot about him. well, he's obviously in cracking form, isn't he, based on the time trial at the World Championships. But no, I think, you know, we've discussed this many times in the past about Thomas's proneness to have, well, crashes and illness and, you know, run up against problems in Grand Tours. And he broke that, to be fair, he has sort of broken that spell of late in the last two or three years. But he's not the most experienced rider at the Giro. He's had one sort of failed or aborted tilt at the general classification at the Giro. And I just wonder about his experience in this particular race. And what do you know about the team they're sending, Rich?
They've got Rowan Dennis, lots of time trials, obviously. Filippo Ganna, another great time trials. Teo Gegenhart is there. Salvatore Puccio, Eddie Dunbar. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know...
It sounds strong.
Hart and Dunbar, the men for the mountains, I would think. Puccio is a great... I've heard Chris Froome rave about Puccio and his qualities as a sort of all-round domestique. Ben Swift as well is down to ride for them. So
it sounds very strong, but again, it's a team that needs to be sort of created anew. The kind of, you know, it's not a team that the main backbone of which has already, you know, got 5 years of Grand Tour experience behind it riding together, is it?
No. I mean, your mention of the Agnello just encourages me to chuck the name of Stephen Kruiswijk out there. He's actually got a very strong team behind him. I think Antoine Tolhoek is there. Koen Bowman is a decent climber as well. Chris Harper. Tony Martin, another one who's gone from the Tour to the Giro. And Tobias Foss, who, as we said last week, won Tour de l'Avenir a couple of years ago. So that's actually a really strong team. And then Vincenzo Nibali is the other one, isn't he, who's there. But I'll chuck Kruiswijk into the mix. You never know. Could be Jumbo-Visma's Grand Tour this year.
And a wild card, you mentioned Nibali, but also on Nibali's team, Giulio Ciccone is, I guess, will not be saying he's going for general classification, but he's a guy whose stock has been rising steadily over the last couple of years and might find himself in a position where he has to or wants to defend a GC position. Could be in the mix.
Indeed. Well, listen, let's leave it there, chaps. Daniel, I'll see you in Palermo on Friday.
It's a downhill time trial to kick off with. Fantastic.
The Lionel Barney stage. Yep. Looking forward to that kicking off. And we'll check in with you, Lionel, as well, from time to time.
Well, have a great time over there. I mean, keep us updated on the food and the wine, certainly. That's what I'll be listening out for.
Mainly that.
If you could send me a time code for the food and the wine so I can listen to that first.
Some nice wine, absolutely.
We haven't had our big, well, Francois and I still need to have our big slugfest over French cuisine. I'm still slightly traumatised 2 weeks on, 2 weeks after the Tour de France. I'm still slightly traumatised by, you know, the culinary ordeal.
You didn't book any three Michelin star restaurants, did you?
Oh, that'll be it.
Lunch with Daniel and Francois. That'd be great to eavesdrop on that. That'd be good, actually. We should do that, shouldn't we? That'd be a good podcast, I think. Francois and Daniel duking out over lunch. Anyway.
That might be the last ever podcast. Anyway.
Okay, thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Rich.
Thank you, Francois. Oh, we've got friends of the podcast.
Thank you, Francois.
Well.
That's,
did I say that? Did I say
grand
Francois?
Grand merci.
I was, that's just wishful thinking. I almost forgot. We've got friends of the podcast to thank. From me, a big thank you to Brian McLachlan, PR Deacon, Mark Stickland, Simon Bone, Simon T-Bone, actually. I like that T-Bone. Tom and Lakeman, James Stannard, and Graham Ritchie.
And a big thank you to Mr. A. Macanjuola, Thomas Randall, D.T. Fletcher, Campbell Goodwill. Is that Campbell Goodwill or is that Campbell Goodwillie? Mr. N.
It's written as Campbell Goodwill, so I think that's
Mr.
What it
N.
is.
Halliday, Michael Achimpong, and Stephen Meek.
And from me, many thanks to Mark Staunton, Justin E. Bangs, Paul Ong, Jan Henkins, Charlotte Sofield, Lawrence Watts, and Christopher Dunn.
And if you want to sign up as a friend of the podcast, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. The most recent special episode is our audio diarist, sort of final installment from the Tour de France.
And also we've got the my trip to the Ardennes Classics, which might be worth a listen, as we have Flesh Wallone and Liège-Bastogne-Liège this week.